Are you stuck in the same old routine at work? Do you find yourself hitting a creative wall, unable to see beyond your current perspective? It's time to break free and unlock the power of fresh perspectives.
David Guthrow with Discover Fresh Perspectives here. And today I have the pleasure of being with Alan Mallory. And usually what I do is I ask people what's something that they're passionate about. And Alan, you said mountaineering and psychology. So I need to know a little bit more of the background to that. That sounds intriguing and welcome.
Well, thanks, David. It's good to be on your podcast. Yeah, I mean, my family set a world record climbing Mount Everest back in 2008. And my father really got me and my siblings into mountaineering. And so a lot of my programs are kind of built around that. It was certainly an exciting expedition of I've written a couple of books that really touch on some of those exciting yet harrowing moments. But I also, I would say I combine a lot of those more, you call them technical or team strategies with psychological strategies, you know, how to improve your life. And I went through my own mental health journey in my younger years. I had quite a severe social phobia and anxiety disorder, known as generalized anxiety disorder or GAD. And so that's really what got me so interested in the human mind. And I've studied it for a lot of my life and I still do. I find psychology just fascinating, which is kind of rare for an engineer. My undergraduate in engineering.
So I want to back up for just a moment because you said mm-hmm. set a record. And what kind of record, like fastest to the top or first family, or was that record all about, Alan?
Yeah, we're the only family in the world. So it was my father, brother, sister, and I. My mother was actually there as well, but she had a fall just above base camp and tore her Achilles tendon. Yikes. So before us, there'd been like a father and son team, I believe, something like that. But it's, you know, it'd be challenging to find for members of the same family that would be interested in even taking on something like that. And then the odds are kind of stacked against you as well. So it was 2 months of some, not something I'd want to go through again, but it was a pretty, pretty incredible experience.
Well, I can imagine that under stress, most families that I'm aware of anyhow, the tension tends to cause some somewhat aberrant behavior. And I would imagine that climbing Mount Everest has a bit of its own stress attached to it. So how did you folks handle that?
Well, exactly. I mean, it helps that we have similar personality distributions. And this is actually from a team environment. If you look at organizations, this is one of the challenges, right? You get really diverse personalities and you're going to have conflicts. Now, when you look at the studies, though, it actually is worth the trade-off, because if you want to have any kind of problem-solving ability or innovation, you need diverse personality. And so, but in terms of just kind of getting along, it is good if the other members of your team are not too different than you. Otherwise, you'll just clash on every discussion. And so, yeah, we have similar interests. That helps as well. And I think my father instilled that in us, and we have similar drive. And so, you know, it's not like we didn't have any conflicts, but I think we were able to, we'd been through other expeditions and adventures before. We've done a lot of family activities throughout our lives. And so we were able to, I would say, not be emotionally drawn in so far that it's going to destroy the relationships when these arguments would come up. You know, focus on what we've come here to accomplish together and not get sidetracked.
So I would imagine that requires a considerable amount of maturity. And it's a good thing that you'd had previous expeditions, because not speaking for personal experience whatsoever, but sometimes you get into a tense situation and all the baggage comes out.
Yep.
I remember in 1943 when you were that sort of thing. So what kind of conversations did you have when you were planning to go on this, Alan? I'm curious about that.
Well, we were planning for about 2 years before, and you're climbing for 2 months straight. And so it's quite a time commitment. And there's just a lot of logistics in terms of the equipment and all of that. And I'm trying to think back to the conversations we had. I mean, certainly the idea started with my father, and it was just around the dinner table about 2 years before we'd set out. And we'd already climbed many of the seven summits. I'd climbed Denali, which, and I would say, when I say we, my father had climbed most of them. He wanted to be the only person in the world to climb the seven summits with members of his family. And those are the highest mountains on each of the seven continents. And he's now done that. And so certainly the idea started with him. But it has to develop into a personal dream, or you'll talk yourself into turning back long before you get anywhere near the end of that 2-month expedition. And that's why so many people do. And so it really did. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but the more I, you know, looked into it and did the research, I really, you know, it developed into that personal dream. It's kind of the holy grail of mountaineering, I guess you could say. And I like to prove to myself that I can, you know, so there's something like that. It really gets at the internal motivation. It would be hard to do a cost benefit analysis on something like this, because the benefit is something like the personal elation and satisfaction you get by realizing that you're able to push through all those challenges and make it a reality in the end. And so that's what I was thinking of the driver for me. We had lots of, I don't remember all those conversations we had. You know, we were pretty aligned, and we decided, look, we're going to try to, you know, look out for each other as best we can, mitigate the risks as best we can, and to make this a reality. It's not like it's without risks. There's some we're accepting, but we're going to do it smart.
And did you go just with your family? Did you take Sherpas? Was it a larger group? Like, what was your actual expedition like?
Yeah, and so it's part of the 2 years was I would say conversations around how we're going to structure our team, because we'd never had a Sherpas or anything like that on the other expeditions, and obviously that's going to introduce language differences, cultural differences, personality differences, all of that. But on Everest, you really can't. As far as I can see, it would be impossible to do it, or almost impossible to do it completely unsupported, because someone has to replenish your food supplies over those 2 months at base camp and extend your visas and all of this stuff. And so we had to start discussing with some outfitters, as I would call them. And most of them weren't interested in supporting what we had in mind. It was basically a self-guided team with some of their support, but a few were, and that's how we got to these discussions. And in the end, we did have the outfitter we went with wanted us to have two of their Sherpas with us, so that if we did something completely out of the ordinary, went off and killed ourselves, as many teams do, they have some sort of connection there. They're also trying to run a business, right? So they don't want our fatalities on their books, let's say.
Right.
And so,
motivated.
Yeah, we had those kind of, we're meeting these two Sherpas for the first time. And so we spent a lot of time trying to break down the barriers between us and them. And we became good friends, I would say, over that expedition. You know, they were happy to have us, because a lot of the climbers there, you know, unfortunately, they're people that are pretty, you know, they've reached the pinnacle of the business world or whatever. And this is, so they kind of throw money at this. They're used to getting their own way. And now you're in a really tough environment, biologically, physically, all of that. And so the tempers are high to begin with, and people lash out, and the Sherpas take a lot of that, the brunt of that. I think they were glad that we were, you know, fairly, what I would say, reasonable people, and that we did try to build a good relationship with them, and they reciprocated. You know, it was the six of us all working together to make this a reality.
Now, I'm curious how you all contributed differently, because I think you said. So it sounds like your dad is a very experienced climber, and the others of the team perhaps not quite so much. So how did you manage to balance the contribution for something as extreme as climbing Everest?
Well, we did have strengths and weaknesses. You know, my brother's an electrical engineer. A lot of logistics around the electronics. How do you make this equipment survive for weeks at a time? So he took the lead role on that. My sister's a nurse. You know, the altitude weakens your immune system, and so you get these awful sicknesses. And really, you're a chemistry experiment in terms of trying to heal yourself from these. And so she really took the lead role when it came to a lot of those challenges. In Nepal, you can get almost any medication over the counter without a doctor's prescription. And so that complicates it further. Often it's not, it's a fake, it's a knockoff. It's not even a real medication. And if it is real, it's not taken properly. And so they create these super bugs from people not completing the course. And so it's a real disaster in terms of the medical. I would say my father took the lead role when it came to, you know, how far we can push into the altitude at a given point without taking on too much additional risk. And those elements, although I wouldn't say he was, let's say, the leader of the team a lot of the times, he was 56 at the time, and he had his own, I would say, altitude challenges. He was in like a state of delirium for all of us were at some points, but he seemed to really be affected by that. And then I was kind of the problem solver. You know, I'm pretty good at getting us out of binds we find ourselves in. And so between the four of us, we worked pretty well. My mother, of course, after she had her injury, we kind of lost that capacity. She was never as keen as the rest of us anyway, though. Oh. And I would say she's kind of the glue that holds the family together, something like that, and not necessarily taking on any of the technical or strategic roles.
So did she engineer her accident, Alan?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I don't think so. She was in a lot of pain, and she was pretty high when it happened, over 17,000 feet. And so just getting out from where she was a real challenge.
And did you all actually summit? I know sometimes teams, they send just, you know, one person up or whatever, and they feel that's a team success. But
no, the four of us, yeah, we all stood and set foot on the summit.
Wow. Must be some amazing pictures.
Yeah, it's pretty neat up there. It's surreal at the time. That's why you want to make sure you take some pictures. Because at that point, we've been climbing for 30 hours straight, right through the night, with no rest and no sleep. And so if you do reach the summit, and you're functioning on a third mental capacity because of the lack of oxygen to your brain. And so it's really quite surreal, and from lack of sleep and all of that. So, but I can remember even at the time, you know, there was that feeling of elation, you know, we'd put a lot into this, the planning, but 2 months of climbing is a long time to finally reached our end goal. It was pretty incredible.
And I imagine that the senior up there was incredible, but how about the selfies? I hope there were lots of those. Like, hey, we did it together.
Sure. Yeah. No, we did get some pretty neat photos, and you're mostly looking down at the clouds from there, but you can see the mountain peaks poking up through the clouds all over the place. So
one thing I was curious about, I'm not sure how this contributed, Alan, but I was looking at all the degrees after your name. Like, you must have a very large business card to fit them all in. So what are the different degrees? What are the different degrees you had, and how, if at all, did they contribute to your contribution in this effort?
Sure. Well, I'm my education is in engineering, and so I actually, my wife and I, we've lived in various countries, and so I've one of them is my U.S. License. We lived in Arizona for 2 years, and then it was in South America for 2 years as well. And that was when I was working as an engineer in custom machine design. And the engineering mindset, it actually can really help with solving complex problems like you're most likely to be faced with almost continuously in a volatile environment like a mountain. And so that really was a big advantage, you know, being able to problem solve. You have to extrapolate from the other ways you've solved similar challenges in life to try to come up with a quick solution to whatever you're trying to get out of. And so that certainly was a major advantage, I would say, in being trained in that. And I would say also having that type of mindset to begin with. Someone's only going to go into engineering if they are that type of the type of person that thinks like that. Now that can be very good from a strategic point of view. It can actually give you challenges from the mental health in the mental health space, though, because I'm so analytical, and I think this is what led me to some of my mental health challenges in my younger years. You're always in your mind, you know, you're ruminating, you can't sleep. And the human mind is not a machine. And so you have to, and that's really when I started studying the psychology elements to try to break free of some of that rumination and make those deeper cognitive changes that are important. And so that's my later degrees. As I said, I eventually went on to get a master's in psychology, which is pretty rare for an engineer, but I was motivated to continue down that path by the improvements I saw in my own life. And still am. I really find that it quite fascinating. If you want to live a good life, some of these psychological strategies that you can learn and develop for yourself are pretty, pretty important. So
now, did I hear you say that you've written a couple of books about this experience, Alan?
Yeah, well, my first book is called The Family That Conquered Everest. And so it's really all about our expedition. It has flashbacks into what prepared us physically, mentally, and emotionally, a lot of the other adventures. And it has sections from my other family members. So that one's quite a edge of the seat kind of people that right after they've read it, it's some version of, if you guys can get through that, I'll get through this. And they kind of share their Everest. And then my new book, Summits of Self, it has adventure narratives to start each of the chapters, but it's more in the psychological space, those practical strategies in making deeper cognitive changes. It's a lot of, they're kind of, some of them that in some of the chapters, they're these weird they're mental activities, so they're kind of mind games that when I first started reading about them and trying them out, I thought, well, this is a bit hokey, but it's, changing the ending of certain memories, for example, and running the right mental movies through your mind rather than whatever your mind feels like running, both in the past and in future. And so, but at that point I was thinking, I'm not going to write off anything. I want to figure this out and not have to let's say be burdened by that. It was really quite I had a lot of continual panic attacks and heart palpitations, and it leads to a lot of really negative physiological effects when you're in something like that. And so then some of those strategies I could see they really were working. When I would think of, let's say, certain situations or memories, it's working because your emotional response, the negative emotional response, is lessened. So then I doubled down on some of those, and I noticed that it also helped me when I was faced with similar situations in the here and now. And so that's why I started thinking, well, as much as these little mind games seem superfluous, or they're not going to be useful, they really work. And so that's what that book is, really quite practical for people. And when I get emails on it, it's usually some version of, it's helped overcome whatever challenge they're dealing with.
So do you hire yourself out to help teams in escape rooms, Alan?
Not so much in escape rooms, but lots of team workshops and things like that. Mm-hmm.
So what I'll do is I'll put your contact information as well as the names of those books in the program notes when
sure,
we're done.
There might
here,
be a few people interested. Yeah,
mm-hmm. People want to follow up with that. So if you were to give just two or three tips to and the listeners, I don't know who's listening to this. Like, I'm not targeting anybody, just anyone that's interested in hearing some different perspectives. If you were to offer two or three tips on, how to think about or work through challenging situations, what might those be? I realize I'm putting you on the spot here, but come on, you've written two books, for crying out loud.
Working through challenging situations. I mean, this is, you make sure it's something that it's a lot easier to, I'm talking about maybe large scale goals that we all set that have layers of challenges on them. And it's a lot easier to summon up the resilience and perseverance you might need to work through them when it's something that is really meaningful to begin with. We end up being kind of pushed in directions by family and friends. And so we kind of think these are goals that are, meaningful to us, and yet they aren't. And so that's where the introspection is important. You know, make sure, and I've tried to do that in my own life, make sure that the things I'm pursuing are actually things that are meaningful, because it's going to be that much meaningful to me, because it's otherwise it's pretty hard to summon up the resilience to keep bouncing back from the adversity. And so that's the first step. There's also being able to control your focus. From a psychological perspective, as far as I can tell, the reason why it's important is because we can only consciously process a small fraction of everything we take in through our five senses. And so you tune your perception to some degree if you're focused on the solutions and the positive elements. It's kind of an old adage, you know, focus on the positive. And some people don't like hearing that at all because there's so much negative in the world. But it matters if you focus on what's in your mind is always the negative, the problems. You know, I've worked with those types of dark cloud people, and you just start to notice all the other problems that are going to prevent you from getting there. Psychologically, as far as I can tell, as I mentioned, it's just the way you've tuned that perception. Otherwise, if you're focused on the positive elements, now you just, they pass by without you even noticing them. So that tends to be pretty important when you're trying to overcome major challenges like that. You know, resilience is a tough thing. How do you kind of instill or learn resilience? And I would say that's through treat the small challenges in your life similar to the large goals. You know, people that kind of are quick to give up on the small little commitments they make to themselves are that much more likely to let a major goal fly out the window as well. And so I'm careful about my internal monologue. You know, if it's something that's meaningful to me and I commit to it, I follow through. You train yourself you convince yourself that you're the type of person that does follow through on those internal commitments. Anyway, so there's a couple of
things. That's great. And like so many things, you know, knowing these things takes practice. So just having to hear you say it once is going to do it. But if people choose to embrace them and get better at it, you know, that will build a capacity, build a capability.
Yeah. And it's a lifelong thing. And the problem is we've been most of our lives developing the wrong thought patterns. And so it doesn't change overnight. It really is. It's a habitual thing where you know, small, purposeful cognitive changes.
So, Alan, thank you so much. I learned a lot of things I didn't know previously about you and about your adventure, which I always appreciate if I can learn something new in these. And I'm sure that those that have been listening have some thoughts about some things that they might do, maybe even be interested in picking up one or both of your books. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, David.
And it's David Guther with Discovering Fresh Perspectives. Who knows what's going to come next, but thank you for listening to this one. Talk to you soon. Subscribe now, because on Fresh Perspectives, every episode is an opportunity to explore new horizons and redefine what's achievable.